Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. Feel free to call in after the first half hour of the show to ask our guests any questions you may have for them. Before I introduce my guest today, I'd like to let our new listeners know that there's language in the 2018 federal budget that will make horse slaughter legal in the U.S. There is also language in the 2018 budget that would allow the Department of the Interior to kill 46,000 healthy wild horses and burros in BLM holding facilities and tens of thousands more on our public lands. We're asking that you please call or fax a note to your senators and tell them that you oppose horse slaughter in the U.S. and that you don't want wild horses and burros to be euthanized, killed, or sterilized. The fate of the wild horses and burros depends on your phone calls. Animal Welfare Institute was founded in 1951 and has been dedicated to reducing animal suffering caused by people. They seek better treatment of farm animals, marine life, animals in labs, companion animals, and wildlife. On today's show, we're going to focus on wildlife and wild horses and burros. For the wild horse and burro advocates who are listening, the promo for this radio show contains links to two excellent research papers on wild horses and burros that were written by Animal Welfare Institute. It's my honor to introduce Kathy Liss, president, and DJ Schubert, wildlife biologists of Animal Welfare Institute. Welcome to the show, Kathy and DJ.
Thank you very much. We greatly appreciate the opportunity to join your show today.
Yeah, thank you, Debbie.
Glad I got the name of your organization right finally. I'm so sorry about that.
Quite all right. The description was perfect.
Yep.
Okay. Can you tell our listeners about USDA's Wildlife Services Program and their out-of-control killing?
Yes, I certainly can. It's a program that is little known and is charged with managing problems that are caused by wildlife. And the bulk of them are, given that it's based there in USDA, related to agriculture. And unfortunately, the great problem there is that so much of their management is lethal management in tremendous numbers and also cruel means of catching and killing animals to the tune of anywhere close to 3 million animals that may be killed in a given year. And the animals that killed really cover a full spectrum from bobcats, coyotes, crows, deer, foxes, and certainly it also includes a tremendous number of non-target animals, those that they did not intend to go after but were caught by mistake and oftentimes killed by mistake.
There's a lot of birds, aren't they?
Yes, tremendous numbers of birds. Agreed.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
If you look at the data and look at the numbers that are provided by the BLM, the USDA Wildlife Services, the bird numbers are astronomical. And I would just add, as a wildlife biologist, that there are methods and there are techniques, some of which have been developed by the USDA, to non-lethally and humanely resolve wildlife-human conflicts. Unfortunately, Wildlife Services just doesn't use them as extensively as they should. If they did, mm-hmm. I think the body count that they accumulate every year could go significantly lower.
Mm-hmm. Right. While the mm-hmm. producers may appreciate having that body count, we would appreciate better use of tax dollars and having them expended in ways that were actually practical and humane and effective, mostly effective.
Mm-hmm.
And that just isn't the case. And while, as DJ alluded, the research that's done is oftentimes quite forward-thinking, what happens in the field and their operations is still in the dark ages. And there isn't that mm-hmm. crossover that we'd like to see of tools that are available that make sense or practices that make a lot more sense that would be utilized.
Mm-hmm. And in case your listeners are interested, just two examples. In 2016, Wildlife Services killed 21,000 beavers. In my experience, the vast majority of beaver-human conflicts can be resolved non-lethally. So I think those are 21,000 beavers that never should have died. In addition, mm-hmm. they killed 77,000 coyotes, and if you look at the scientific literature on coyotes, killing them is not solving your problem. In many cases, killing coyotes is making your problem worse because, in effect, you're creating super coyotes that are not susceptible to being trapped. And because coyotes are so wily and because of their mm-hmm. reproductive characteristics, if you kill coyotes, you're simply inviting more coyotes to come and live in the area. And instead, mm-hmm. if you use a non-lethal approach, if you teach ranchers, if you teach people that have domestic livestock like chickens and sheep and lambs to use common sense protections, people can live harmoniously with coyotes.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up the common sense solutions because aren't there special interest groups that are probably pushing for these animals to be killed? Like they just want to get rid of them? Like
well,
ranchers
or,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, the way the Wildlife Services works is they have agreements with state agencies. They have agreements with county agencies or county governments. They have agreements, and then they can enter into agreements with individual ranchers to assist them in addressing their wildlife conflicts problems. And there are cases where the Wildlife Services agent will go out and have a discussion with the rancher or the landowner and offer them some non-lethal solutions, but way too frequently they immediately turn to lethal control at the behest of the rancher or at the behest of the grazing association or whatever entity they're working with, and then they set out their traps or they get up in the air in helicopters and aerial gun coyotes or using, you know, poisons or other techniques to try to eradicate the problem. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been concerned for a very long time about this cyanide capsules that spray all over the place because I'm worried too many other animals are accidentally killed. And it seems
yes.
like a lot of that is going on.
Yes, and certainly Congressman Peter DeFazio has been a leader in Congress trying to ban the use of compound 1080 and sodium cyanide, which are commonly mm-hmm. used for the predator control.
Good, good. I know that AWI works hard to protect wildlife, and wildlife is considered a public trust. Can you tell us a little about the public trust?
In North America, the historic importance of wild animals has been sustained by laws rooted in the premise that wildlife can't be owned by people, but instead is held in trust by the government for benefit of all the citizens. And one reason the North American model of wildlife conservation has been hailed is as the greatest model of effective conservation worldwide is it rests on that philosophy that wildlife is a public resource and held in trust. While we say that, the reality can be somewhat different in that state by state, the management of wildlife rests with the state game agencies. And their funding comes in part from those holding licenses to take animals through lethal means. And they then oftentimes have decision-making that's geared towards seeing that as their constituency rather than the broader constituency of all people in those states.
And just to simplify this for your listeners, the basic premise of public trust is that the deer in your backyard, the squirrel in Kathy's backyard, the blue jay in my backyard are not ours. They belong to everyone. And the idea is that when, because they're in the public trust, those agencies, federal or state, responsible for managing them have to take into consideration all the interests of all the citizens, not just those who enjoy hunting, fishing, or trapping. And as Kathy pointed out, at the state agency level, all too frequently the commissions that oversee the work of the state agencies are comprised primarily of ranchers, hunters, and other people that are engaged in exploitative uses of wildlife. And it's very infrequent that you see someone that's a biologist or someone that's an animal advocate serving on these commissions. And therefore, as Kathy said, their decision making is not consistent with the public trust doctrine.
By way of example, and initially my studies were in wildlife management, and when hunting season came, it was an excused absence, and most of the class was gone. It's important to recognize that the interests need to be much broader than that. And as DJ said, typically you've had to then just abandon those with the wildlife management background, perhaps, and look to those that may have biology because they may have a broader based education.
And the state wildlife agencies and their governing commissions, and frankly even the federal government, should take heed to some of the data that just recently was published by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in its 2016 survey of hunting, fishing, and wildlife related recreation, because in that data they demonstrated that the number of hunters from 2011 to 2016 has gone down, the number of fishers or fisher people have gone up, but the number of people engaged in wildlife related recreation and the amount of money they're spending, whether it be bird watching or going hiking and trying to see deer or bighorn sheep or whatever,
is
skyrocketing, and it's bringing in a great deal of revenue to local communities and states and even to the federal government. So,
yeah,
there's value for these agencies to start recognizing that, you know, the old way of doing things has to change, because there's a much larger and more powerful constituency out there for non-lethal or non-consumptive use of wildlife.
Yeah. Well, wildlife management falls into two categories, lethal and non-lethal. Could you explain to our listeners about each of these?
Sure. Well, and lethal management, as the name implies with the word lethal, is those animals that are taken by hunting, fishing, and trapping. And that's particularly when the trapped animal is killed, which sometimes there can be live trapping and release of animals. Nuisance wildlife control, which involves, as we described, the use of poisons. It may be sharpshooting, hunting, trapping, or use of fumigants. And alternatively, there's non-lethal management, and those are harassing animals, frightening them, repelling them, ways that you prevent wildlife from engaging in certain behaviors or occupying certain areas. You can use exclusion, for example, as a way to keep them out and avoid conflict and prevent them from causing harm or damage to other wildlife.
Well, and one of the wildlife issue involves trapping. And I didn't know much about this. I mean, just a little bit, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about the different types of wildlife traps and what each one does?
Certainly. Probably what we consider one of the most cruel devices currently used across much of the United States is the steel jaw leg hold trap. And it has been used so widely because, in essence, it's very easy to set, and any animal that triggers the pan on the trap will get caught. And while the trapper may argue that they're looking for a specific species, oftentimes they're happy to get any fur-bearing species that's going to bring them some measure of income. The trap itself works by two jaws that slam together with bone-crushing force on the foot or limb of the animal who's caught. And you have both a closing force and a clamping force. It's been equated with having your hand slammed in a door, and they can't get out, and causes excruciating pain. Typically, it restricts circulation to the area of the limb below the jaws of the trap. Oftentimes, as I said, since any animal that triggers the trap can be caught, non-target animals, which includes your dogs and cats, can get caught in these traps too. The damage that's done can require amputation of the animal's limb because of the permanent damage that's been done. For the trapped animal, because of the excruciating pain and being held, they will struggle desperately to get out of the trap. Some species are known to chew off their own limb to get out of the trap. Other animals, foxes for one, tend to bite at the trap desperately trying to get out, and they chew their teeth away right down to the jawbone. So really quite archaic devices. The U.S. should be ashamed for continuing to allow its use, as there are more than 100 countries around the globe that prohibit it because of its cruelty. And so certainly sorry, go ahead, DJ.
Well, no, I was just going to also add that the other kinds of traps that are often used in the U.S. are conibear traps and snares, both of which are sort of kill traps, and both of which are incredibly cruel. I guess snares can be used if they're set up the right way as traps that just capture an animal, but oftentimes if the animal's captured, and if it's the target animal, the trapper will come and kill the animal, often using, you know, very cruel methods. There's another type of trap which is often referred to as a dog-proof trap, and there's various models on the market that anyone can find on the internet: the egg trap, the little grizz getters, the Duffer's raccoon trap, and these are primarily designed to catch raccoons and possums, and they work differently than like the leg hold trap, because instead of the animal stepping on a plate and setting off the jaws, the animal has to reach into a trap, pull up on a mechanism, on a lever, and that releases a jaw that then captures the animal's foot or paw against the side of the trap. And despite the fact that they're considered to be dog-proof, and therefore the idea is they won't capture non-target animals, the reality is they still capture non-target animals. I mean, sure, a deer is not going to be able to get its hoof into one of these traps because the opening is so small, but any animal that has a small enough paw and that has the manual dexterity to reach into the baited trap and pull up on the lever, or just to wiggle the lever, the lever could be trapped. And again, I've seen the traps, I've operated the traps, I've touched the traps, and I can tell you with certainly, particularly after getting a finger caught in one of the traps, that it is very painful, and the traps can certainly cause, and the scientific evidence demonstrates that they cause, you know, significant injuries, including self-amputation.
And we consider them to be enclosed steel jaw traps, that in essence they're just within a metal casing for the most part, or made out of other materials than the egg trap. But sadly, in many states that have prohibited use of leg hold traps, they are being offered as being a different type of device, and their use is very widespread and growing across the country. Even those that have dogs and have an animal caught in a leg hold trap, are only too happy to have this device used instead, except that oftentimes they use lures that are going to be of great interest to domestic cats. And what we know oftentimes happen is when a domestic animal is caught, they don't want an animal limping home. And in fact, one of the serious problems about this enclosed trap is it's extremely hard to get a trapped animal out alive, because they're going to be fighting you while you're struggling to release the trap. And so instead what they do is kill the animal and dig a hole, bury it, and you just don't see your cat again. very tragic situation.
Yeah.
And then
go
ahead.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to comment then on the strangling neck snares, which are probably the least expensive, and that's why they can be used in great numbers. In essence, just a snare loop that's set out, and an animal puts its head through it as they're walking down a trail that they commonly use, and it tightens up and slowly strangles the animal. And it is an, excruciatingly painful death, one that allows a tremendous number of non-target animals to be caught, just a real serious problem.
And I would just add, Kathy made a good point about these dog-proof traps and how difficult it is to get non-target animals out of these traps. Again, since I've used them, since I've not used them for trapping, but since I've manipulated them, since I possess one of each of the kinds of traps that I mentioned, I've been able to envision how you could, if you set this out and caught a cat, for example, how could one trapper on his or her own go out and remove this animal from some of these traps, given that some of them have to be literally taken apart to remove the animal?
Mm-hmm.
And it would be impossible. I just can't fathom how a single trapper could do it on his or her own.
Yeah, even with a crowbar or anything, it would be just, I can't either, because the animal would be so panic-stricken and probably in shock from the pain. You know, even if it was a domestic animal, they'd be frightened. Yeah. How many trappers are there in the U.S.? Go ahead. Finish that thought, DJ.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add that these traps are horrific devices to capture and kill wildlife. What makes the situation even worse is, of course, different states have different what they call trap check times. So many states have a 24-hour trap check time, which in my opinion is far too long than it should be. But there are some states that have trap check times that are even longer than that. The state of Maine in certain areas has a trap check time of 72 hours. I've heard of other states you know, as long as you check your traps every 5 days, you're working within the law. And those types of trap check times are just so excessive that, you know, it's just shameful that any state would think that that's at all humane.
Or Alaska, that doesn't even have a requirement on how frequently you go back.
Oh, no. How many of the states allow these leg hole traps? A lot of them? A lot of states?
The vast majority of them do. There are those states. Florida, for example, has an administrative prohibition. Other states have done it by ballot initiative. But the vast majority of them do allow use of steel jaw leg hold traps. One example that we were speaking of regarding the dog-proof traps was the state of New Jersey, which had what we considered to be the strongest prohibition on steel jaw leg hold traps, banning sale, possession, use. And instead now the trappers put forward the enclosed leg hold trap, and those are being used, and we did attempt to fight that in the courts, and we're continuing to try to fight that in the legislature. But you have a state that went for quite some time in ensuring that you didn't have that kind of brutal treatment of wildlife, and it's been undone in a really short period of time by these so-called enclosed leg hold traps.
Yeah, it's just as bad.
And
trappers. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry to cause you interrupt you again, but just to add to what Kathy said about New Jersey, it's just to give a demonstration of what the impact is in terms of animal lives in regards to using these dog-proof traps. Prior to the year after they started using these traps, the number of raccoons trapped in New Jersey increased by 5,000, from around 7,500 to 12,500. There's no, I can't say that all those extra 5,000 raccoons were caught with these dog-proof traps, but I think there's a great likelihood that once they authorized the use of these traps and the trappers had sort of these new tools, these new torture devices to use to trap raccoons and other species in New Jersey, that, you know, that increase has probably a lot to do with the fact that these dog-proof traps were authorized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many trappers are there in the U.S.? Do you have any numbers on that?
There are some estimates, and it's believed to be about 170 or 180,000 trappers across the country.
Wow. And how many animals do they trap each year? 3 million or something like that?
It's hard to get a firm figure on that because some states just survey the information and then, a small percentage and then extrapolate to the rest. Some, of course, is not reported. So we don't really have any way of knowing, but, I mean, our guesstimate would be 4, 5, 6 million, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. There's also the issue of penning. Can you tell people what penning is and why it exists?
Yeah, sure. Penning involves taking coyotes, live coyotes and foxes, and putting them in pens, basically fenced areas, for the purpose of training dogs to hunt. A lot of states that permit this are in the South or the Southeast, and it's seen as sport, it's seen as entertainment, and the hunters use it to ensure their dogs are capable of going out and, you know, tracking, you know, these animals and catching them. In some cases, as I understand it, the pens may have little cubby holes that the animals can escape into and they can't be accessed by the dogs, but all too frequently the dogs are able to corner the animal, catch the animal, and rip the animal to shreds, the coyotes and the foxes. And often those coyotes and foxes are wild animals that are just captured elsewhere and captured live and brought to these pens and released for the purpose of this this spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems almost like dog fighting to me. I mean, I saw a video of it, and it was awful. It was pretty horrendous to watch.
Beyond the cruelty, I know there's some evidence published in the scientific literature regarding the potential for disease transmission. So if you're catching coyotes and foxes from, you know, one state and bringing them, you know, four or five states over to use them in some penning operation, you're bringing with them, you know, whatever bacteria and viruses and pathogens
or rabies
that they've picked up in their state, and that you're introducing it into this environment where those pathogens may not be found. And so there is a disease concern as well.
Yeah. So their dogs, their livestock, their soil. Yeah. It's getting all over there. I have a question. These coyotes and foxes are wildlife, so they should be under the protection of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, correct?
Well,
so couldn't they
Fish and Wildlife Service, the protections afforded by the Fish and Wildlife Service are limited to endangered species, migratory birds, and wildlife on refuges. The Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't have any role in the management of foxes and coyotes unless they're on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service land. So most foxes and coyotes are under the authority of state wildlife agencies, and nearly just about every state that I can think of basically doesn't have any restrictions on coyote hunting, coyote trapping, you know, so on and so forth. Some of them might require hunters, trappers to have licenses, but oftentimes with coyotes, it's just a free-for-all. That's not the same with foxes. Foxes, there's generally a season where they can be legally, you know, taken, legally trapped, legally hunted. But for coyotes, it's often a free-for-all in most states.
Mm-hmm. What states allow penning? Do most states allow them? Or, again, I'm wondering how much of the U.S. Allows this penning to take place.
Of course, the shorter list is those that don't.
And as I said earlier, most of the states are in the South or Southeast. You got Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia. But you also have states that, you know, frankly, surprise me that they actually permit this activity, and that would be California, mm-hmm. Delaware, New York,
wow.
Maryland,
wow. Wow.
Virginia,
well,
Wisconsin. In some cases, as I understand it, it's not that the law explicitly, that the state law explicitly allows penning, but it's that the law does not prohibit penning. And so, mm-hmm. you know, you do have states where this type of activity is explicitly prohibited, but I think in other states there's still a need for state legislatures to get involved and to recognize the cruelty associated with this activity and frankly how it gives, you know, hunting and it gives hunting and hunters a bad name and why they should enact legislation to ban these activities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know, first of all, I want to remind callers, if you want to call in and ask a question, Kathy and DJ would be happy to answer your questions. Just dial 917-388-4520 and then press 1, and our producer will let us know when you're on with your question. So can you tell us about the National Wildlife Refuge System, and do these refuges allow trapping?
Okay. Well, the stated mission of the refuge system is to administer a national network of lands and waters for conservation management and, where it's appropriate, restoration of fish, wildlife, and the plant resources and the habitats in the mm-hmm. United States. And this is intended for the benefit of current and future generations of Americans. And unfortunately, trapping is permitted on a number of different fish and wildlife refuges, which we consider a conflict in these places being intended to be a refuge for the animals. And mm-hmm. there is legislation that has been introduced to prohibit the use of possession and use of different body gripping traps, and that would include the steel jaw traps that we've talked about, conibear traps, and snares. Mm-hmm. And that bill is called the Refuge from Cruel Trapping Act and is sponsored by Congresswoman Nita Lowey of New York. And the bill number is H.R. 1438, if people want to contact their members of Congress and encourage them to co-sponsor. The legislation currently has 77 co-sponsors.
Oh, great. Good. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, everybody. H.R. 1438. Ask your congressional members to co-sponsor that.
And I would just add that, you know, it's having done this work for an extended period of time, I know that, you know, you frequently run into people who think that refuges are, in fact, refuges, that they're sanctuaries for wildlife. And when they find out that, in fact, all sorts of exploitive activities against wildlife are permitted on refuges, they're really quite surprised. We're not just talking trapping, but hunting, fishing, livestock grazing, you know, mining. The number of secondary uses permitted on refuges is really quite startling. And mm-hmm. the reality is that the Fish and Wildlife Service that manages the refuge system every year opens more refuges to hunting, fishing, trapping, and other uses. The way the laws are set up, there are six what they call priority uses. Those priority uses include hunting, fishing, wildlife photography, and others. Trapping is not considered a priority use, but unfortunately it is permitted on, you know, nearly 200 refuges based on a list of refuges open to trapping that's available mm-hmm. on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's webpage.
Yeah, this is very similar to the Bureau of Land Management. All the wild horse and burro herd management areas, there's so many other uses on them, it's a wonder they can find one blade of grass, especially in areas of Wyoming. There's so much oil and gas.
Yep.
You know, all over their herd management area. So it's not an equal sharing of uses, and you know, as you know, our wild horses and burros are almost going extinct at this point with all these other uses driving them out of their what are supposed to be their federally protected areas. I have kind of one broad question related to so much wildlife being killed. Doesn't it really affect our environment adversely when you know, they're doing this? And how does it affect it adversely?
Well, I mean, wild animals have a role in the ecosystem, and when you're tinkering with the those animals and you're disturbing them, if you're killing them, removing them, you're disrupting that function, that ecosystem function. Obviously, certain animals are predators, certain animals are prey. So if you remove your raccoons and squirrels and things like that, you can affect the predators that rely on those animals for food. The animals have other values in terms of caching seeds and transporting seeds from one place to another in their fecal deposits, and and then they also have value if they were to die. If they were to die naturally, a lot of people think, well, it's just a waste. If they're going to die anyway, why can't we trap them and hunt them? But the reality is that they die in a natural environment. Their body decomposes. It provides food to a whole assortment of animals, from scavenging birds to little microorganisms in the soil. It enriches the soil. So there's great value. It might be sort of morbid to say, but there's great value in death when you're dealing with wild landscapes and wild ecosystems.
Let's not have that be the quote from today, though.
No, yeah.
True.
Yeah. Well, just, I was just curious. You talk to us a little bit about endangered species?
Sure. So, the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973. It's one of the strongest laws, not only in the U.S., but around the world, in terms of its the protections it affords imperiled species. It's contrary to the opinions of some members of Congress who see it as a impairment to development and as a tool that hasn't saved species. The reality, it has saved species. It is saving species, but we have to recognize that it takes time to save species. If a mammal or a fish or a bird is declines to the point where it needs to be listed on the ESA, you need to start to examine what the threats are to that species and try to mitigate those threats so the species can rebound. And sometimes that takes a lot of time. The ESA is jointly administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service. Fish and Wildlife Service has primary responsibility for terrestrial and freshwater organisms, while the National Marine Fisheries Service covers whales, other marine wildlife, and fish such as salmon. There are different categories. There's an endangered listing. There's a threatened listing. With each of those listings comes different restrictions on what can happen to the species, what's permissible, what's not permissible. And there's also this issue called designated critical habitat, which is often key to protecting and recovering the species. I mean, it's one thing to protect the species and to say you can't, hunt this species, you can't trap this species, or, if you can, you have to do it under certain restrictions. But oftentimes you need to protect the habitat, obviously, to recover the species. And at the moment, there are about 2,400 species of animals and plants protected under the Endangered Species Act. That would include your endangered species and your threatened species. And that's broken down into about 1,450 animals and 945 plants. And of the animals, about 630 are animal species found in other countries. So the ESA is not only applicable to U.S. species, but it's also applicable to species found in other countries. Unfortunately, this Congress in particular is entertaining a number of bills that would, if they were passed, if they became law, they would significantly weaken the protections that the Endangered Species Act affords to these species that are imperiled and desperately need, this type of federal protection.
A record number of amendments have been introduced by Congress to undermine the law in various ways, and it has never been under such relentless attack. And particularly trying to shift from very much a science-based approach to protecting threatened endangered species, and one that has an incredibly successful track record, to then letting the decisions be political ones instead.
Yeah, it's frightening. It's frightening, and I think the only thing that's going to help with the Endangered Species Act and the Wild Horses and Burros, if all of our listeners, people, it depends on every person making phone calls. We can't just sit back anymore and think, oh well, you know, these organizations can take care of it, because we can inform people and we can do our best, but we need people to make phone calls or just fax a note. You know, you can write two sentences and fax it to your congressman or senator, and they really weigh it heavily then. But I think, you know, do you agree with me in that? We really need people to make phone calls and get active at this point?
Yeah. Absolutely. Polls show that the vast majority of people care about the Endangered Species Act and protecting endangered species, and we need those masses to really speak up, that to not do so means this law that has done such a job and that so many species rely on to survive into the future is going to be lost, and the animals will be lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure this is probably on your radar, but our Director of Wild Burro Affairs, Marjorie Farabee, has done several radio shows because millions of donkeys are being killed all over the world for their skins. That's somebody calling with a question, but I just want to finish this thought. They're being killed for their skins to make a Chinese herbal medicine called Ijiao. And is that on your radar, too? Have you guys heard about that?
Well, I certainly have seen a number of articles about that. I've collected them. I've read them because AWI is very engaged in, you know, international wildlife trade issues and the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. You know, donkeys are not, of course, protected under CITES at the moment. I mean, there's no reason that – I don't think there's any reason that they couldn't be, and I'm certainly alarmed not just by the number of donkeys being killed, but the purpose for which they're being used. It's not uncommon for China and other Asian countries to be significant consumers of wildlife, and many of the wildlife species or parts or products that they consumed are used in traditional Chinese medicines. The reality is there's simply no empirical evidence that the magical powers that are ascribed to these products are real, and so in a lot of cases, people might be, rhino horn's a perfect example. A Vietnamese diplomat one day decided to say that a relative of his was cured by consuming rhino horn, and all of a sudden, the demand for rhino horn skyrocketed in Vietnam because people are desperate to help cure their loved ones of cancer, when there's absolutely no evidence that rhino horn does anything, because rhino horn is nothing more than keratin, which is the product that is in our fingernails and our hair.
Yeah, interesting. I think we have a caller. Debbie, do we have a caller on the line?
Yes, we do, Deb, from area code 303. And
hi, excellent program. And I just wanted to ask a question related to the phone calls to Congress about these issues, the endangered species, but also the wild horse and burro threat. And, you know, there are so many lies being put out about the wild horses and burros, that they're feral, that they're overpopulating, that they're starving. AWI did a wonderful booklet, I think it was published in 2009, that was really credible and laid out all the facts. And my question is, does AWI plan to update that that booklet? And the other is, what kinds of alerts are you putting out? Because I'm a member of AWI, and I'm, you know, a horse-interested member, and I haven't yet seen any of them, but I hope they will be coming, because time is so short on this. Thank you.
Yeah, we're just getting into the horse section of our program. We were saving that for last, but thanks for calling with that question. Go ahead, and you can answer that, and then I'll start
bringing up some other stuff as we...
I can try to answer part of it, but then I'm going to have to defer to Kathy on part of it as well. But
okay.
I think the caller was referring to managing for extinction.
Correct.
That has been revised. That has been revised once, but it hasn't been revised in a number of years. And whether or not we're going to do a new revision of it, that's a question for Kathy to answer.
Okay, and we don't have plans for it at the moment. That it is a tremendous undertaking. We do have a lot of up-to-date information available via our website. And DG, I think we recently put your exhaustive report on wild horses up, do we not?
Right.
Well,
I think so. Yeah.
And the two reports I have linked to on this radio show promo were managing for extinction, which was, I think the last one was 2011, and that's the version I have. And then in 2012, you did that great report for the National Academy of Science, and that was so great because I don't know if our, you know, there's maps for all the grazing allotments that covered each herd management area. There's pages on why the BLM, you know, there are reasons for taking away land. It's a great, great resource, and a tremendous amount of work went into that. I could see it. It's excellent. So I'm really encouraging everyone to read those papers.
And we have some other information. I know we have a myth and fact sheet, and we have information on wild horses as native North American wildlife. And even for kids, we have coloring pages that are available on the website.
Yeah. Well, a couple of the points I wanted to ask you, you know, one thing is they're always saying wild horses and burros are feral. Could you kind of address, or non-native, can you address this?
Well, as Kathy just pointed out, there's a fabulous document on the AWI website that goes into great detail of the archaeological record that demonstrates very clearly that wild horses are native to North America. The detail is so significant, I can't even reiterate it here. But the reality is that a number of scientists have looked at the fossil record. They looked at other evidence, and it's quite clear that the modern horse and many of the modern horse's ancestors evolved in North America. Some of those species then moved to Asia via the Bering land bridge. And ultimately, the horse, as they knew it, back in the day, died out or disappeared from North America 11,000 to 13,000 years ago. But then it was brought back. It was brought back by the, some of the explorers, Columbus and others, and basically the horses were released into Mexico and then recolonized, I guess you could say, the rest of North America. So the idea that they're not native is it makes for an interesting academic debate, but I think the debate has been addressed through the work done by a number of scientists from a legal perspective.
I'll be sure to put a link up to that under the radio show promo so that people are listening to the archive version of this radio show can know the exact place to go and look for that.
That'd be great. I was just going to add that from a legal perspective, whether they're native or not native is completely irrelevant because we have the Wild and Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act that protects them. Should protect them. Wild and Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act does not distinguish between whether they're native or non-native. It simply, provides ostensible protection to both the horses and the burros.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to know that. Although they've been, that the ranchers and all the cattlemen's associations. That's a big point they bring up. Oh, they're non-native, and I feel like going like cattle are.
Right.
Can you tell us, our listeners, about the beneficial role of wild horses and burros in the environment?
Sure. They have a number of beneficial roles. I think it's important to recognize that no one can say that wild horses and burros don't impact the rangelands, because they do, but so does everything mm-hmm. else, whether you're mm-hmm. talking about mm-hmm. wildlife or domestic livestock. But in the planning documents that the BLM puts out, they often forget to recognize the beneficial role that wild horses and burros can play in the environment, and that includes they can disperse seeds, not only seeds that get attached to their coats, particularly the burros, but also in their fecal deposits. They which helps to reseed the landscape. They can blaze in snowy country. They can blaze trails that other animals can use. They can break ice at watering holes that makes then the water available to species that don't have the strength, the girth of a horse, and can't break through the mm-hmm. ice. And obviously, mm-hmm. They can serve as predators for those predators that are capable of killing either, an adult horse or a foal. In addition, there's been recent news that has come out suggesting that they can act, they can help reduce fuel that sustains wildfires on public lands by eating some of the undergrowth. That I think is still a benefit that still needs more study to really understand just how beneficial they can be. But it does make logical sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think we have another caller. Deb, do we have another person calling in with a question?
Yes, we do, Deb. From area code 530, you are live and on air. Welcome to Wild Horse Wednesdays. Go right ahead.
Yeah, do you have a question? Hi.
Oh, hi. Great show. Thank you. There's so much to cover. I was going to bring up something about the burros. I'm going back to 2012 when they were going to have a burro roundup in Arizona, and see if I can read it correctly. I do these shows better in the evening. At any rate, a petition of stay was filed to stop the roundup because wild burros at that time were on the endangered species list. And the Fish and Wildlife Service promptly revised the endangered species listing and changed the burro's scientifically accepted name. And the wild burros had a new unendangered name, and that removed them from the endangered species list. And that allowed the North Baja Pipeline Expansion Project, which was an international gas line, to cross through Yuma, and it crossed many states. And it basically, federal agencies, they all rolled over, but specifically the BLM were the ones that rounded them up, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. Fish and Wildlife Service was very helpful in revising their. They now had an unendangered listing, and they by rights should be endangered, especially right now. I think that may be the only thing that will save them, because if this goes through, and we're going to fight like crazy to stop it, and I think the Senate probably will, but the only way the Senate will be able to stop this appropriations is by us really pushing. And I'm trying to get the white paper that was just released to every senator. I just faxed a whole armload of them to Senate a couple days ago, and I'm calling to follow up. And anybody that can do that and at least call them, so they have the information that the data that's being given to them is from BLM is false.
Yeah.
It's fraud, basically.
Well, I think your question was that they changed the name of this particular donkey from what it was to something so it wouldn't be protected anymore. I think that was your question or the point
exactly.
you were trying to make.
Yeah. Right, the burros will just immediately, because they're going to be worth a lot of money now, and so they round mm-hmm. them up, they disappear as it is, but mm-hmm. we're really, this is an emergency situation, our horses and our burros.
Kathy or DJ, do you want to respond to that?
I'm not directly familiar with that case. I do recall seeing articles regarding some change in the listing of a donkey-like species on the Endangered Species Act. I think there are wild I'm not sure what they're called, but there are wild donkeys that are native to Africa that might be under the ESA, and it could be that the way it was listed, it gave ammunition to those that wanted to try to use that to stop a wild burro roundup. But again, I'm not directly familiar with that particular case. I do know that in Arizona, of course, unlike Wyoming, Nevada, and other western states where wild horses predominate in Arizona, wild burros predominate. And, you know, there certainly has been concerns expressed by the Arizona Game and Fish Department and others regarding the alleged adverse impacts of wild burros on not only vegetation but also some wildlife, particularly up in the northeastern corner of the state.
Well, we found, there was an aerial census that was basically another fraudulent, what was it? I forget the numbers on it because I don't have that right now because it's all on documentation. But the problem that you have there is the bighorn sheep hunters. Basically, that's where the money comes from that goes for their agency that is supposed to protect the wildlife there. So the burros do not bring in money. But there were what would they say?
Sherry,
on this?
I'm going to have to cut you off. We're getting to the last few minutes of our show, so
okay.
I want to get back to Kathy and CJ to kind of wrap things up. But thank you for calling in, and appreciate it.
Yeah, and I can just really quickly add that the caller is absolutely correct. In Arizona, bighorn sheep hunting brings in massive amounts of money, and so there certainly is no surprise that the Arizona Game and Fish Department would have this bias against wild burros if they think the wild burros are in any way, shape, or form impacting adversely bighorn sheep populations.
Well, Kathy and DJ, we're kind of getting to the last few minutes of our show. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up?
No, I think we emphasized, and I'd like to say again, for people to get active and to contact your members of Congress, and there's even a number for the general switchboard that if you know your representative's name and your senator's name, you can just call 202-224-3121 and ask to be connected directly. And so I encourage anybody, if they haven't done so, to please do so. Also, I hope people will visit our website, and we're happy to share whatever information we can, and if there are issues or questions that didn't get answered today, we'd be happy to respond to those. And one other thing I want to emphasize about the Animal Welfare Institute that perhaps wasn't covered so much is that since our founding, we've taken very much a science-based approach to everything we do, and we also try to focus on the most amount of animal suffering and needless suffering that could be prevented. It's caused by people, and we look at practical ways to address it and to try to reduce the sum total of animals that are being killed and greatly reduce the suffering to the extent we possibly can. And again, greatly appreciate the opportunity to be on today.
Oh, great. Well,
I
want everyone
and
to,
I would just,
yeah, go ahead.
No, I would just emphasize Kathy's point about people needing to get involved. If you're interested in wildlife, if you're interested in wild horses and burros, these animals are under threat like no time before, and it's really important that people get involved at the local level, state level, and, of course, the federal level to, you know, speak out and speak to the decision makers and try to compel them using science, using the best arguments you can come up with from your research to do the right thing.
And I want to be sure, just have everyone go to the website for Animal Welfare Institute. That's at awionline.org to learn more about all the great work they're doing. And Kathy and DJ, thank you so much for taking the time to be on our radio show today. We really appreciate it. I want to thank our producer, and Debbie, I'd like to thank Debbie Donimer for filling in today. And there's two other radio shows, Voices Carry for Animals on Tuesday nights, and Whistleblowers on Thursday night. And our guest next week on Wild Horse and Burro Radio is Stephen Nash, who will be talking about his new book titled Grand Canyon for Sale. And he'll be talking about how our public lands are being sold off. So be sure and tune in next week. Thank you, Kathy and DJ, and thanks for everyone for listening.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.